the Agile Uprising Podcast. Hello and welcome. Today we are jumping into the next step in the Agile Manifesto author review. Today we are very lucky to be joined with Mike Beadle. I am going to be co-hosting today. This is Ryan Lockard, and along with me from the Agile Uprising is James Gifford. So first and foremost, Mike, welcome aboard.
Thank you, guys.
Cool. So Mike, we've done this conversation a few times with a bunch of your cohorts, your colleagues, however you guys, the fraternity, however you guys want to frame yourselves. And it's been enlightening. It's helping to set the context for the folks that are unaware of the events prior to the Agile Manifesto, the event itself. And it helps, I think, really it makes an attempt at building a time capsule of information that otherwise I don't think is available. So to get us started, for anyone that's not familiar with Mike Beadle and your professional life prior to 2001, can you just help set some context? What were you doing? What was your domain? What areas of interest did you have? That type of thing. What was your professional space prior to the Agile Manifesto event?
Sure. I was trained as a physicist in 1987 or so. I was completing a master's and then a PhD in physics. And so I came into software development when the object-oriented world was just taking off. In fact, I went to some of the early object-oriented conferences thinking this was the way that the industry was going to go. And I found myself in the room with people like Ken Beck and Ward Cunningham and Grady Bush and eventually Jeff Sutherland. And so these are the same people, per se, that wrote the manifesto. But I got a job at IBM in 1987 or so. And IBM kept calling me because I was, I guess, the only person that they knew that knew object-oriented stuff back then. Mm-hmm. And eventually made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I did not want to, per se, be a computer person. I was a physicist, and I was invited to work at IBM basically under duress, meaning that they were paying me too much money and it would be stupid not to join them, you know. And so that's the way I came into the industry. Over from 1987 through about 1995, I was in a record number of failing projects. Maybe they didn't call them failed projects, but we had, you know, very many projects that were years late, not months, years, wow. 2-3 years late. And they had run budget overruns, in some cases, close to $1 billion, you know. I mean, it was really, to me, was almost unfathomable, if you will, that we even finished these projects in some cases. I was in a few abandoned projects. And just to give you the context, I had joined a number of companies in their efforts, including Goldman Sachs, American Airlines, IBM, and then later William Mercer, and I was very frustrated. So I had joined the software development industry. After 1995, after I found Scrum, I spent 5 years doing Scrum before we went up to write the Agile Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like a miracle drug kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a project that was nearly 3 years late with a $50 million budget that had been failing. And we say that project, when I compare the productivity ratios of what we were doing before Scrum and after Scrum, it was a few thousand percent, close to 10,000% actually productivity improvement. Don't be too impressed because, you know, when your productivity is zero, anything looks like infinity, right? I mean, and so that's after 1995, I started doing Scrum. I was very active in the conference space. I used to be a conference organizer and a workshop organizer at the conferences, especially from the perspective of organizational patterns. I joined, made really good friends with Jim Copeland and Jeff Sutherland, and we would basically run around organizing organizational patterns conferences. Right around that time, I became more interested in management patterns. And so I wrote a pattern language for organizational design, if you will. And so I started doing more management consulting right around 1996, 1997. And so so I came from that background, you know, large scale enterprise development and then management consulting. And even in 1997, I had done a Scrum project that was out of, you know, out of software, non-software Scrums, you know. Anyhow, that's my background.
So just out of curiosity, as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, were you in any way involved in the Sentinel project?
Not directly. The way I came involved in the Sentinel project was because I trained some of the people in Washington, D.C. I've been running these Scrum classes for the last 7 years or so, and I almost do a one every month or one every 2 month class in D.C. Mm. And some of the Sentinel people were in my class. In fact, I don't remember the names offhand, but they were in my class a few times. You know.
Cool. So, thank you very much for the background there. I think I learned quite a bit about you, actually. So do you remember, I guess it was probably in 2001 itself, you got a phone call or an email inviting you to the event. Do you remember who sent you that email and what the context of the invitation was?
Sure. It was an email by Robert Martin. Robert Martin and Martin Fowler apparently had this bright idea to write a manifesto, start a revolution, and change the world. and I might be able to find that email somewhere in my archives, but basically said that, you know, Mike, you want to come along to join us in a mountain or wherever, you know, an island, I think was the original idea, write a manifesto and change the world. And then it's kind of a funny story because I thought, you know, what a bunch of crazy people. Yeah, I'll join them, you know. And so so I knew Robert from the conferences. He and I were good friends, and he's also from Chicago. He actually lives not too far from me, maybe 3 or 4 miles away from me.
Oh, wow.
So he was, as I was, we were very upset because we would say projects, and after we would say the projects, the clients would fire us. And they say, you know, thank you for your hard work. We'll call you when we have another emergency, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was distressing just because they kept going back to the stuff that didn't work, you know.
Yeah. We spoke with Bob, James and I did, right? And it was about 2 weeks ago, and I've never laughed so hard through a technical interview in my entire life. It was amazing. He's a great person.
He's a great guy. He is a great guy.
I feel like as much as I feel like I bother him now, I'd bother him more if I lived 2 or 3 miles away from him.
I have lunch with him every now and then, and he's a very funny person. Just like you said, he's just a great guy to hang around.
Yeah.
And extremely bright, of course, you know.
So your gateway into the invitation, I'm assuming, but I think it's an educated assumption, was the early work you were doing with Sutherland and Schwaber with the Scrum framework?
Sure. I mean, I was invited because I was the second person that implemented Scrum after Jeff. Mm-hmm. So as far as I know, Martin the boss from Belgium and I were the second people that, you know, I started in mid-1995 when they were still working on the Uppsala paper, and I based a lot of the stuff with emails to Jeff or emails to Ken. And so, and then we wrote what we call now the Scrum Patterns article, which was the second published paper on Scrum. The first one, of course, was the Uppsala 95 paper, and then ours was the second one, which was the Scrum Patterns article, you know. But yeah, I had been doing Scrum for 5 years. I was very vocal in the news groups and the conferences, you know. In fact, I was the only, back then, I was the only organizer at any conference, you know, related to Scrum. So yeah, we knew each other very well.
So what was how did you get connected with the Scrum guys, with Jeff and with my brain just went blank. Ken, How did you get?
Well, I was an object person, and so Jeff was an object person. So I used to attend his business object workshops, and so he started doing this business objects workshops in early '90s. You know, '93, '94, '95. So I was part of that workshop, and I knew Jeff from those workshops. And so one day, in early 1995 or so, I get an email that says, Mike, you should try this thing I call invented called Scrum. I have measured up to 600% productivity improvements. And to be honest with you, I was like, you know, he must be joking, or he lost his mind or something. I mean, you know, to make such a claim was outrageous, right?
Right.
But then I knew Jeff. I knew he had a lot of credibility. I had met him personally at the conferences. And moreover, I knew that his office was co-located at the MIT. And then that's literally where he invented Scrum, at a seminar in the so-called subsumption architecture, you know. So I met him through the object technology community.
That's awesome. So let's set our mental context here to Snowbird 2001. As I understand it, you guys basically had an informal gathering the evening before the first planned day. If you could just put your mind into the earliest memory you have about that 2-day event, be it the night before or the first morning, can you describe what you were seeing, what you were sensing, what you were feeling as you started making the connections with these guys and you started hearing why they were drawn to the event, and just help paint the verbal picture of what it was like to make those early connections in Snowbird?
Sure. So my first impression, it was a sunny day in Salt Lake City. And I can't remember the exact temperature, but it was, you know, mild temperature. We started going up the canyon, and literally after one turn up the canyon, everything was snowed out, you know. So my first impression is like I'm in some kind of warp universe where you make a sharp turn and all of a sudden there's snow, you know. I mean, it looked like a sunny, you know, warm day, you know, for someone in Chicago in the 50s, and then you make a turn and it's 32 with snow, you know. And so I was going up in one of these little buses that takes you over the resorts, and I was thinking to myself, I don't know if this is a complete waste of time, or, you know, what will happen. There was a little bit of uncertainty, if you will, thinking, we're going to write a manifesto and change the world. Let's see how that works. But, I mean, there was certainly a lot of skepticism from my side, thinking, you know, I'm here, you know, but I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Yeah. So when you guys all start connecting for the first time, I'm assuming, well, you knew Jeff, you knew Ken. How many of the others were you familiar with? Or I guess the inverse question is what I'm asking. Who didn't you know? Who were the first?
Interesting question. I knew Ken Beck in Ward from the PLOP conferences.
Right.
And I knew them well because I had interacted with them I've been interacting with them for maybe 5 years. I knew Ken and Jeff because I had seen them before. Ken and I were already planning to write this book, you know, we were just talking about writing the book then when we went on the mountain. The other two guys from XP, you know, James Groening and Ron Jeffries, I had never met them in person, but I had interacted with them, you know, through the XP, Extreme Programming mailing list. The other guys, I didn't know that much. I didn't know John Kern. I did not know, any of the other guys from the Pragmatic, you know, Dave Thomas and so forth.
And
I knew Alistair also from the PLOP conferences. The PLOP conferences are, of course, Pattern Launch of Programming conferences.
Yeah. And so you obviously had familiarity with Scrum and XP. Since you knew Alistair, I imagine you had some awareness to Crystal.
You know, to be honest with you, I have heard from it. And I guess, you know, I will say this in front of Alistair. There were so few instances of Crystal, you know. I mean, in fact, I think there was 4 flavors of Crystal. And one of these flavors had only one instance, you know. So there was one group that was doing Crystal Clear, I believe, you know. Anyhow, I did know him. He was certainly a personality already in the use cases and patterns, communities, but not from Crystal, not so much from Crystal, from the patterns community.
Did you know anything of DSDM that brought Ari there?
No, I did not. I did not know Ari, and in fact, I did not know much about DSDM or FDD. So I did not know much about that.
Cool. So I was told that Martin, being the great facilitator that he naturally is, was the one that I think first tried to harness the conversation. You have 17 type A engineering and scientific based people. You're going to have a lot of opinions going through that room. And if the story was told to me correctly, and I've heard it from at least three people now, so I'm thinking there's some sense of truth to this. Martin kind of got people together and said, hey, let's just get out some index cards, jot down what it is that we're passionate about or what it is that we look to accomplish here. It's either a word or a phrase, and we'll just throw it into the middle of the room. Does this sound familiar?
That's what we did, and Martin is the one that, the joke was that thank God for the XP guys, because they brought the index cards into the room. Otherwise, you know, it would have been a lot harder to get to do anything, you know.
God, it feels like I'm interviewing Alistair all over again, because he said the exact same thing. Well, I think actually Alistair had his flavor to it, where he said, those damn XP guys must have come together and decided we're going to do this, because they all had the index cards.
Exactly. And that really was a good contribution. It sounds trivial, right? But it really was an important contribution that they had the cards with them, you know.
Yeah, and what I understand, the way the story goes was that after throwing enough cards in the center that you have a pretty good population, you all went through and did an affinity mapping so that like and similar ideas got grouped into different themes or different piles.
Correct.
From there, you basically created a self-forming agenda.
Exactly. So it was a little bit... felt like now a little bit of modern open space, you know. I'm not sure if it was conscious or I miss the fact that it was conscious, but it felt like if you go to one of these modern agile conferences, it felt a little bit like a modern open space, you know.
So
I'm not sure that was deliberate.
Yeah, no, but it worked. And, you know, obviously jumping ahead a little bit, the outcome was pretty significant, so it damn sure worked. if you could think back, and I'm going to ask this in the context of you as Mike Beadle, do you remember anything that you wrote on any of the index cards? I believe there are some flip charts on the floor as well that you guys were filling in, but do you remember anything that you wrote that you were passionate about? Not that it was your idea that got into the manifesto, but just something that brought you there.
You know, to be honest with you, offhand, I don't remember anything that I wrote on those cards. No,
it's incredible, man. Like, you guys are very consistent in that piece.
I'm you know, thinking hard and going by memory, and I just don't remember, you know. Yeah. I just don't remember anything that I wrote down, you know.
No, that's fair, and it's actually kind of amazing. One of the things that we're trying to understand is who brought what to the table.
Sure.
And it seems like that's one of the mysteries that will go unresolved, because you guys are all very protective of the fact that there was no individual contribution here. You guys as a collective came forward with these ideas.
Yeah, at least the all of the ideas. I can tell you that on the second day, the person that became the scribe, if you will, was Ken Beck, you know. Ken Beck started writing something like, so we believe in this, and then we would say yes, but you know, but we don't believe in this other stuff so much and so forth. But I mean, he was the guy writing the stuff on the board, you know.
Yeah, and I heard some amazing stories about the way that the word agile came to be, right? There was an activity where you went through and determined, like, I think everyone wrote down what names they wanted, and then you went through a reduction exercise where you took out the ones that you could not live with. And then it wasn't that anyone was really strongly saying, yes, agile is the term. It was just the one that everybody agreed they could live with. Is it?
It is true. I mean, I can tell you, I came up with that word. That's the one thing I remember. I came up with that word because I was familiar with the book, you know, from Goldman, and which is the author? The other author is Ron Goldman. It's Agile Company. Where you see? It was Ron Gold. Not Ron Goldman. If I remember the title.
I'm looking out on Google right now, but I'm coming up empty here.
Agile Competitors and Virtual Organizations.
Okay.
That's what it is. Agile Competitors and Virtual Organizations. See, I was at IBM when our manager brought this stuff. IBM became part of the so-called Agile Consortium. And they brought this stuff about, you know, after the bankruptcy of Chrysler, the U.S. was really afraid that we'd lose competitive advantage towards Japan, China, and Germany. And given that one of their largest manufacturers was bankrupt. And so we had proposed, I have here actually in some of my notes from that day, we had proposed adaptive, essential, lean, lightweight. And so adaptive, we did not want to give that name because Jim Heisman had given that name to one of his works, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Essential sounded too kind of corny kind of thing, you know, or maybe, you know, overly, you know, proud or something.
Right.
Lean had already been taken. Nobody wanted to be a lightweight. I remember when we finally decided, I mean, I casually suggest not, don't think that I had this planned or anything, you know.
Yeah.
I casually suggested to use the word agile. And I remember Martin Fowler said, well, Mike, the only problem is if we use agile, we're going to be successful, you know, and everybody laughed and we went with that, you know.
Nice. But
it was not really, if you will, we were doing this late in the second day, and it took us maybe a few minutes just to decide on this, you know. So it wasn't really even that part of a thinking, you know.
Do you remember any of the things that did not go so quickly? Something that might have had either a higher level of disagreement or needed some more verbal coaxing to get through?
You know, the one thing that stuck to my mind, because I was a little bit frustrated, you know, in maybe even mid through the second day, it was that we had a hard time. We had sort of like a writer's block, you know.
Mm.
We were not able to write anything down for almost a day and a half. Nothing was written down in terms of my, it were just like very loose ideas, you know. Mm. And so more ideas like we like this and we like that, and we, you know, but it was nothing concrete about a manifest or something, you know. And so that was maybe the one thing. I mean, at the end of the second day, and that's after 4 o'clock on the second day, things started to pick up.
Was there a tipping point? Was there something that happened that broke the writing block?
Well, I think the fact that Kent Beck, we were still arguing and, you know, talking back and forth, and he approached the whiteboard and he started writing stuff down, you know.
Mm.
And so I thought that was significant. That right. was significant because that broke the writer's block. And so we, you know, he would write and we would basically come around him and give him, well, no, you know, it's not that we don't like these things, it's that we only prefer to do these things and so forth, you know.
Yeah, the idea of the double positive statement is amazing, the this over that. It's not that we disagree with the second part of the sentence, it's just we prefer the first part, right?
Exactly. And I think that's what some people still today have a hard time understanding. It's really not that we hate documents or hate processes. You know, I mean, Scrum has a backlog, which is technically a document.
Mm-hmm.
We have a process, you know, which has, you know, the planning, execution, review, retrospective, refinements, and things like that. But we prefer other things, of course, you know. And so that is really the thing that still... we're not going to throw completely the whole world. We're just going to say that these things are more important than other things. You know?
Yeah, that's great. So still at the event, the way I understood the day was structured is you had three sessions. You had morning, afternoon, and evening. And then in between, there was some downtime.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great idea. I mean, you're doing some heavy knowledge working, so you probably need some time to retreat and just do some mental hygiene.
We need some time to ski.
Well, that's the question I'm going for here. There's three or four main things I heard happened at these breaks. It was either skiing, hot tubbing, the lounge, so getting some drinks, or going back to your room and writing.
Right.
I think all you already tipped your hat. You went skiing?
Well, I was skiing one time, and I, you know, to be honest with you, I remember skiing either on the, I can't remember if it was the first day or the second. I did one skiing and maybe just one hanging out session, you know. Hmm. But I think they went skiing a second time and I didn't go for whatever reason.
You know? Yeah. How are you as a skier?
I'm okay. You know, I remember one incident, which we're skiing together with James Groening and Jim Highsmith. Mm. We're up somewhere in the mountain, and, you know, I would ski the blues and the blacks with them sometimes. And then all of a sudden, Jim Highsmith looks at me and he says, "Mike, don't follow me or don't follow us." And he goes down this crevasse, you know, and I'm like, I'm just looking at him. I said, well, I was not even thinking of doing that, you know. I mean, literally, he's going down a slope that looked to me like 70 degrees, you know. I mean, it was, I don't know how they did it.
See,
I lost him after that, you know.
There's many non-parallels in our lives, and this is one more. My wife is a world-class skier, and when I go skiing with her, she says, "Follow me," as she goes down the double blacks, hoping. So, and by the way, I am not a world-class skier.
I'm an okay skier, but no, I'm not as good as Jim or James. James looked at him after he said that, and he just went down the, you know, down the crevasse, and I was just staring at him like, you know, I mean, I would die if I go down that way.
Yeah. Well, thank God they lived so you could finish off the project. Otherwise, we might not have had the manifesto at the end. So, coming out of the event, I understand you guys had the four value statements, and then you worked on the principles via email after.
Yeah.
Obviously the industry took off, and we kind of look back to the Agile Manifesto as one of the catalysts to the Agile movement, right? That was kind of, without using the same term again, but the tipping point for a lot of things that got set in motion. The bold question I have is, did you foresee the aftermath as it actually turned out to be? Like, what was that your, did you have any inkling of an expectation that this whole industry that we have now was going to come from that event in Snowbird?
No way. no way. I mean, I can tell you when I was coming down in the bus, when I was coming down on the bus from Snowbird, I was thinking to myself, I only hope that a few people go, let's see what happens if a few people go to the website, you know. Mm. But, you know, I mean, our hope was that a few hundred people will go see the website. What has happened today? Someone sent me today an article about people in psychology are doing now things with Agile, you know.
Oh, I've heard of, yeah.
There's all sorts of things about, you know, and you probably will see a lot more in that group. There's Agile sales, there's Agile marketing, there's Agile leadership, there's Agile. I mean, it's getting out of control, you know. I mean, it's really, I mean, I never foresaw all of this stuff.
Mike, I don't know if you've heard this one yet, but there's Agile marriage counseling.
I did not, but I will remember that one.
Yeah. So in that, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it is just getting out of control. I mean, I know of people doing Agile for managing churches, you know. That's for example, Jeff Sutherland's wife, which used to be a pastor at a church. Mm. And there's, all sorts of things like that, which is, you know, Agile databases, Agile finance, Agile budgeting, Agile, you know, HR. And all of these things are pretty hot. I mean, they're almost like multi-billion dollar industries, you know. I mean,
but why do you think that is? Why do you think there's such a hunger for Agile to be applied outside of IT like that?
Because, and I take a couple of minutes in my class to explain this, because the rate of change in the world has increased so much that basically all of our management techniques for strategy, for marketing, for sales, for HR, everything, for innovation, right? everything has changed because we live in a different world. The 21st century is almost, it's almost like it's a coincidence that we wrote it so close to the millennia, because, I mean, the 21st century calls for a world of rapid change. And you cannot manage anything, not software development or not hardware development or not compliance, HR, marketing, with the traditional management methods that we have. I mean, this is a new wave of management techniques that comes together, you know, Scrum and Agile, if you will, are what ties the bigger picture. But then you have a Lean Startup, you have Blue Ocean Strategy, you have Business Model Generation, you have Exponential Organizations. I mean, all of this stuff beyond budgeting, all of this stuff adds to what we had before as management techniques. Literally, you pay an arm and a leg to get an MBA and just to learn techniques that are outdated by 30, 40 years.
I love that. I love that statement right there. Yes. Yeah, completely agree. So I guess it's another broad stroke of a question here, but what are your thoughts on the state of Agile over the last 15 years? Are there aspects of it that you think the industry got right and other areas that were straying off the path?
Well, that's a great question, and I will answer it in two parts. You know, the concepts themselves, I think, still stand the test of time. Not that they shouldn't be evolved. You know, I will tell you, I will be very glad to see the next evolutionary step, if you will, in the works. You know, I think there's contributions from very many different areas. I think the conceptual part is still works. What is disappointing sometimes, and you know, and again, that comes with an understanding that the implementations go through cycles of improvement, and because so many people is their first go, and they maybe just have misunderstandings or they're doing it on the cheap. There's a lot of bad Agile and a lot of bad Scrum. When I see that, and the problem then is criticizing the Agile and Scrum, not criticizing the implementations. You know, there's a lot of gripe, if you will, on why Agile and Scrum are not working. People are ready to toss them out the door, and when they don't really have a new alternative. But it's fashionable in this day and age to just come up with something, slap a label, and just say, well, let's now do blah, blah, blah. And it turns out to be almost the same thing.
Yeah. I'm curious if you've seen this before, but it's kind of a weird perversion of Scrum where some people take Scrum and try to rigidly install it. And in doing so, they actually remove the agility from Scrum. Have you? How do you feel? I mean, have you seen this? Have you experienced this? And
all the time. All the time. So, and this is, you know, it goes with a long explanation, right? But this is why Scrum is a framework. Framework is not supposed to be something rigid. When people say we're installing the Scrum process, hopefully not, because Scrum is not a fully defined thing. You know, when you implement Scrum, you're supposed to fill in the gaps with the solutions that make sense for you. In other words, there should not be any two Scrum implementations that are done the same way. People should implement Scrum, basically just the framework and fill in the gaps with what they need to do in context, you know.
Yeah.
And so this is a problem that we have. People want canned solutions, you know, and people essentially want to have just an execution plan, but it's not that easy. If you really understand the Agile ideas, it's all about understanding what makes sense in context, you know.
Yeah, I like to frame the conversation around principles and practices, right? The practices are meant to just help get you toward the principles. The principles themselves never really change. They stay relatively stable.
Exactly, exactly. And so the problem that we have is we have one too many people stuck in basically in what they used to know, which in other words, You look at the startup community, which, you know, I'm fairly interacting, you know, interacting with them all the time. And same problem in the startup community. We used to have the concept of a business plan, and you just had to execute the business plan. Well, it doesn't work like that. It's the same thing as development. It's the same as a transformation. It's the same as, you know, growing a company. It's all about finding out what you don't know, you know. In the 20th century, just because we knew we could make, you know, things didn't change that much, so we could play, we could make longer plan in longer time horizons. In the 21st century, things change so much, but you know, you can make a plan, but you have to be ready to toss that plan and modify it and adapt as you go, you know. And so that's what I see, for example, and it's frustrating for so-called agile transformations. I have literally seen a Gantt chart on how to install Scrum, you know. Or you know, just like you said, you know, people take Scrum and they want to install it, you know, out of the box with no changes in it.
Please don't let me be wrong here, but I believe you actually championed the idea of using Scrum to run the transformation. Am I right?
I've been championing that for the last 16 years or so, and I can tell you, you reach very similar conclusions. Everyone that has been involved in a successful transformation, you need to know you have to adapt the transformation as you go. So. Yes, I have, you know, and there's a few other people, of course, that eventually reach the same conclusions, you know. But I don't see how people just do it literally with a Gantt chart, you know. I mean, it's just not possible.
Yeah, and based on what you were saying about the rapid ideation of the business plan in the startup community, is it safe to assume you're a fan of Ash Moira and the Lean Canvas and that whole?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, in the Enterprise Scrum book, which I'm finishing as we speak right now, I have what we call the Enterprise Scrum Business Model Canvas. I also have a way to create canvases based on Enterprise Scrum. You know, so you have, for example, compliance management. You have marketing, you have startup management, you have agile software development. What do these things have in mind? They evolve models over time. You know, you look at the business model canvas, evolving the cost, revenue, partners, customers, value propositions. You know, and so you have a business model canvas that evolves in time, and that's how you manage your startup. You know, but I mean, this is a very interesting area to me, just because it's really managing things in general, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. I have this strange love-hate relationship with the startup industry, and the hate generally comes. Hate's a really strong word, but you know, it fits the paradigm here. The idea that success is driven by the amount of venture capital investment that you get, it bothers me. It bothers me to my core. And I think as ideas like the ones you're purporting, where we're coming up with ways to capture value as rapidly as possible, and value is actually people invest, like actual customers consuming our product, is really what I believe the heart of the startup should be.
I disagree with you, and you probably know this because you quoted, for example, Ash Moira. I'm a fan of Steve Blank. You know, I think Steve Blank is the person that, you know, so if you read Steve Blank and you come back to the Scrum community, and you know, then you would ask, so how do we, and you read Alex Osterwalder's Business Model Generation, right? So how do we take a startup and evolve it, you know, instead of having this stupid idea about a, you know, business plan that we're executing, right? And you see so much cash wasted on that, because they don't adapt stuff as they go. Lean Startup was a great step in the right direction. Lean Startup doesn't tell you how to build the MVPs, if you will, so you can build them with Scrum. And internally, if you will, the emergent behavior behind a Lean Startup would be Scrum behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have the guys like Jeff Goldthoff with the whole Lean series, right? So Ash is in the Lean series. You have the Eric Ries book. You have Jeff Goldthoff. The idea of taking those ideas that were cemented in the startup movement and actually bringing those into the large enterprise and start doing the entrepreneurship work is quite awesome. And you can leverage Scrum with great success to do that. So,
absolutely.
You mentioned Enterprise Scrum a few minutes ago. For anyone that's not familiar, first, can you just give a quick, you know, 30-minute elevator pitch and just let people know where they can learn more, because I think it's a little bit more than we can unpack in the time remaining here.
Sure, no problem. So Enterprise Scrum is making Scrum generic enough so that people can do it in any domain. So that's the high level elevator pitch, if you will, you know. And so you can say, well, you know, it is really easy, but it gets more complex when you actually do it in the trenches, right? So you have a lot of parameters that change. You know, are you doing, for example, what's the definition of done for, you know, a business goal? What type of activities do you have in the executive board instead of the development, you know, environment? So you may be talking about, instead of the so-called product backlog item, we gave it some other names so that it's easier for people to work with them. You know, if you ask someone in compliance to do a product backlog, they'll tell you, I'm not building any products. And so we gave this name called the value list to the product backlog. I recently, 2 weeks ago, I went to talk to Jeff and his team at Coming and presented the whole enterprise framework to them. They actually liked it a lot. And to be honest with you, that was for me a very, very important step, just because if Jeff and his team, which are some of the best Scrum people on the planet, like it, it probably means that everybody will have a positive a feel about it. You know,
it definitely shows that you're onto something. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can tell you, when I share some of these ideas with some of the best coaches on the planet, they tell me, Mike, we do this stuff. We do, for example, I'll give you one. So when you do Scrum for executive management, most of the work that you do is making decisions. So your product backlog or your value list, as we call it in enterprise Scrum, is really decisions to be made. There's really little work to be done like we do in development or so. And there's things like that. There's I have people doing portfolio management, for example, for mutual funds. Mm. And what they do is they don't do any work, but they monitor the trades. They monitor the stuff on the portfolio. You know, and so I guess what I'm trying to tell you is there's ways to parameterize what we do in Scrum so that it fits into general management. And that's basically what Enterprise Scrum. Enterprise Scrum has different names, pretty much the same roles, and about 80 parameters to customize Scrum so you can fit it to manage anything.
And it's enterprisescrum.com with the Enterprise Scrum book coming out in 2017?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
The Mike Kuhn Signature Series books?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, I wish you great success with that. I will be pre-ordering that and look forward to getting my hands on it.
Well, thanks. I mean, I can tell you, Scrum is not the only way to do this. And to be honest with you, I'm piggybacking, if you will, into having so many Scrum people in the world. There's other ways of doing this thing. You can easily come up with another agile method, if you will. But since Scrum is my thing, and I seen it on the field, and I coach people with Scrum, so that's why I went with Enterprise Scrum and not with something like Business Agility or something like that.
Cool. So I have two remaining questions, Mike. My first one is, are there any regrets? Is there anything that came from either the Agile Manifesto or it within the industry in the last 10 or 15 years that you look back at and you're like, I kind of wish that never came to be?
Not really, to be honest with you. I'm more on the positive side. I think even the criticisms, you know, are positive. You know, if I think it's important for people to air out even criticisms. So there's nothing in that regards. I think everything has been, at least in my view, fairly positive, you know.
So then grabbing on the second question was the positive question. I never like leaving on the negative. What is the, if you could talk to the next generation of Agile practitioners and say the one thing that you want them to understand or to grab hold of and really take to the next level in the world of Agile, what would that thing be, or what advice would you give to this next generation?
So I would tell them, take this as take the Agile ideas and as a good starting point, a starting point that maybe get you further than what we had as management in the 20th century. But don't stop looking, keep innovating, even in fact keep questioning the techniques and keep questioning what's the better way, you know. I mean, the only way to evolve eventually is to piggyback and stand, quote-unquote, stand in the shoulders of giants, right? So don't be afraid to take it down. If you do find good reasons to evolve it, to improve it, go ahead, right? And so don't stop. Don't stop here. Go take it further. You know,
it's beautiful. Thank you, Mike. Is there any plugs that you want to put in to drive people to either Enterprise Scrum, your Twitter, your LinkedIn, or anything?
I do have maybe just the Twitter account, if you have that. It's just twitter.com, and then it's Mike Beal after that, you know.
Sure, we'll make sure we get that in the show notes. I think that's all I have. James, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I mean, ultimately, Mike, I think covered pretty much everything I was going to ask him, ironically, in his discussion on Enterprise Scrum. I've been really focused on teaching at the current engagement I'm on. I've been spending a lot of time teaching business areas how to do Scrum. I mean, I'm working with the internal audit group right now here at the client I'm at. So everything that he was saying with Enterprise Scrum, it literally covered the gamut of the questions that I really wanted to ask. And, you know, your work, Mike, you're definitely taking Agile outside of IT. And, you know, we've seen a lot of success with the, you know, internal audit groups that we're doing, as well as some of the direct mail communications that we're doing with our client or with our customer base at this current client. So, you know, I think our biggest challenge has always been, the thing that we struggle with most is actually mapping terminologies, bringing that domain specific terminologies into, you know, this piece of it. So to hear that you kind of, you know, that you've started to come up with some intelligent names that span across domains, I think that's going to, you know, really help take, you know, these agile principles into IT. So thank you for that. And I'm definitely looking forward to the book coming out.
Absolutely. I can send you guys a link. I have an article as an introduction in medium.com. Mm-hmm. I can send you that to you guys if you want to take a look at that. Just, it has all of the names in it, you know.
Yeah, I'll make sure we get that tweeted out for you, and we'll add that to the show description as well.
Absolutely. And so I want to thank you before we go to you guys. You know, I think you guys are doing, you know, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, the some of us that are in the trenches, we're just busy. We're just too busy to stop and ask these questions, you know. But I think it's useful for the community to sort of retrospect into what happened and to, you know, point out maybe to the future. I'm actually looking forward to read all of the other stuff from the other co-authors, yep, and compare notes, if you will. And so do send me a link when you publish this stuff. I would like to take a look at it. So I think this really serves a purpose, I think, for everyone to bring more understanding, you know.
Thank you very much, Mike. And that's exactly what we're after. So I will make sure I get you a link that's on agileuprising.com. We incrementally update the table. So as we talk to the 17 of you, we add links to it. So it's a living, breathing document. We practice what we preach.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thank you, guys.
I know.
This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by VGroup Digital. VGroup Digital provides native cloud-based software development services on iOS, Android, web, Mac, and Windows, as well as enterprise product development, maintenance, and support. VGroup Digital is led by a team of agile practitioners who believe in collaboration, constant feedback, and delivering the highest value at all times. Visit www.vgroupdigital.com for more info, and mention the Agile Uprising podcast to get up to 15% off all development services.